Again, welcome to the third panel, which is what we will be discussing today is what are the risks once you're invested in some of the countries in Africa? What are the risks that will face you? How do you protect your assets? Who do you go to? The way we'll do this is I will let every panelist introduce themselves, speak for a few minutes, and then we'll turn it for questions. So with we will start with Dante.
Thank you. Thank you, Fadi. I think, let's see if I'm on. So good afternoon, everybody. Nice to see everybody. Fadi, thank you. And so my name is Dante Disparte. I'm the managing director for Clemens Worldwide. We're a company that is specialized in risk. We have active insurance policies, active clients in more than 180 countries, covering the entire spectrum of unfortunate events. Additionally, I have a special connection with the American Security Project. I sit on a few of the advisory boards that we have here. One of them is the Consensus for American Security, and the other, together with Fadi, is our Business Council for American Security. And when we conceived of this event, it wasn't singularly about Africa and risk and investment in Africa. It was also the correlation of American security and the impact that American firms will face and as a consequence the economy will face by not having access to what, in my opinion, is the next 100 years of growth. This is, for anybody who doubts it, in my opinion, this is the African century. And so hopefully what we will address in this panel is what you do before you get there, how do you address risk once you're there, and how we could move the risk discussion from a cost of doing business to a catalyst for doing business. And I think the panel that we have this afternoon will hopefully give some credence to that debate and also lend some practical solutions. My company, as I'd mentioned before, we specialize in the entire spectrum, from the individual risks that will occur, what I call the people behind the P&L, to the risk to the tangible assets once you've invested them, also to then, of course, to the exposure to the equity and the ability to repatriate the profits and the earnings that you get from a market expansion choice. But my knowledge of risk in Africa is informed by a completely different set of experiences. So prior to returning to the US, I used to be the managing director for Land Rover in 32 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. This is real risk. This is not notional. These are very, very expensive cars whose landed cost into a country after tariffs, after duties, after capricious regulators decide that on that day the white Range Rover is going to be worth 200% more. This stuff doesn't magically disappear in a balance sheet. You have real failures. You have brick and mortar buildings that don't magically disappear when everybody runs for the border. And so everywhere from French-speaking countries to Portuguese-speaking countries to English-speaking countries and places in between, that's where I've informed my personal understanding of risk in the African context. So from a business vantage point, the issue I think a lot of firms face is they're on the sidelines. And they're using the standard playbook to approach risk in the African context, which incidentally, it's not. And we've heard, and I think the only correction to the earlier panels is that we've generalized too much. We're talking about a continent with 50-plus countries. We're talking about a continent with a northern region that has a very different cultural, economic, and environmental characteristic than the rest of the region. You're talking west, you're talking east, you're talking south. And to approach risk, which is by default heterogeneous in the African context, with a homogenous strategy to address risk is just absolutely a failure. To approach risk, I think the way so many of us do, with an underwriting checklist, looking for loss information, looking for historical data, looking for correlations, looking for math and statistics in the African context, is by default a failure. And my recommendation for firms looking to tap into this growth, because it is real, it is going to happen, and when you extend the investment horizon out long enough in the African context, Ebola will look like a blip in the radar. Famines will look like a blip in the radar. Boko Haram will be corrected. And the only story that would have been told in 100 years is that this is where the firms that got it right got their value. And so if the United States, through its institutions, through its government agencies, through its entire apparatus doesn't figure out how to give American firms access to this, our national security is at stake, right? Our economic competitiveness is at stake. Another group that I'm a part of is the Harvard Business School. I've just put myself on, I'm now the lightning rod in the room, so you could ask me all kinds of fun questions. But the Harvard Business School is now defining economic competitiveness in a very, very interesting way. A country is competitiveness. It is competitive to the extent to which its firms can compete in the global economy while raising the living standards of the average citizen, right? This is from Dr. Michael Porter, a man who once upon a time said, all business is a zero-sum game, and I win at your expense. So this is a profoundly different shift in how we're defining business and how business has to compete. And the correlation to American competitiveness is direct, it's linear, and Africa is a big part of the solution. So with that, I think that's a good opening statement from my vantage point. But,
thank you. My name is Barbara Samuels. I'm the executive director of a non-for-profit, the Global Clearinghouse for Development Finance. And we're good bankers, okay? We're good bankers that are dedicated to mobilizing the private sector for investment, for competitiveness, for security. And it's a special honor to be here because I served on the original Hart-Rudman Commission on National Security, where one of the great debates, and I had one with Speaker Gingrich, about how do we define national security and moving away from seeing security as just oil. So it is really an honor to see that there is a recognition of the true nexus here. And I totally agree with what you say. And with that, and I'm also very honored to be here with the leaders from our government that are really trying to push the envelope. But all of that, and there's a report that we did for the African Development Bank on risk mitigation needs and solutions. There's copies of there. But, you know, we work and see the opportunities in Africa. And there are a lot of opportunities, and we are failing. We are failing as a country to be able to protect ourselves, to be able to protect Africa. And there's, you know, the evidence is very clear if you look at the statistics, whether it be growing unemployment, especially among the young, the problems with crime, with terrorism. You know, we've been working, for example, in Tanzania since 2009, and a diplomatic friend of mine said, beware, Barbara, there are paramilitary camps now. Okay? You know, we are losing the battle. It is a wake-up call. So what is it we need to do? We can solve this. We can. But I think what we need to do is to convert a lot of the principles and the visions that we have into a factory that actually works. And the first principle of a factory that works is working from the ground level up. You would never have a successful business if you didn't work directly with your client. And what does it mean in the universe we're talking about? It means being able to, and it's a real challenge in the development world, to take different countries, different institutions within that country government, and focus on a deal or a set of deals. So just to give you an example, Tanzania, where we've been working, today, despite hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars given by the government, the World Bank, development partners, still I think it is 80% of the population doesn't have access to energy. There is a working group of development partners, 20 of them. And there's huge money being given. And, you know, different governments have more flexibility than we do with our government. For example, the Swedish government is a huge provider of funds through the World Bank, through other institutions, to the World Energy Agency. We have worked with project sponsors of the World Energy Agency, at least 20 of them. And the first problem they have that any, and this could be, you know, a major company. We've also worked with the Aga Khan guys, the Industrial Promotion Services. First problem you have is how do you make a project viable when you're probably selling to a utility that isn't creditworthy, Tenesco, or you're selling off grid, and the people you're selling to today, because they don't have energy, they're not economic. Do they have the ability and willingness to pay? So, you know, the first problem you have is lack of funding, no matter who you are. We lobbied the Aga Khan guys to work on projects. We finally got them to agree to do one in Uganda, but it was because the agency we were working for, the UN Capital Development Fund, had agreed to subsidize the technical study of $400,000 for only a 1 megawatt mini hydro. But that's what it costs. Those are real costs. And then that deal died because the grant funding didn't come through. You know, it is an incredibly convoluted process. Then you get to the smaller development project sponsors that come from communities. The fact is, most of the energy projects that have worked in Uganda and in Tanzania are faith-based organized. There are the church, especially ties to the Italian church, and non-for-profits from Italy. The project sponsors we worked with, many of them only spoke Swahili. They had never run a business, and they didn't have any working capital. Try that, trying to be a financial advisor. So, and then you get, if you expand the circle, you go project development costs to training. You have to have real training. Today, there are workshops, for example, that have been sponsored by development partners. You have a 2-day workshop, a 5-day workshop. Do you think that solves the problem? Of course not. You have a lack of banks willing to lend on a project finance basis. The classical way is over-collateralized, your personal collateral. You can't. You can never do a project wherever you are on that basis. So we have a training need to show local banks that it's economic, it's sexy, they're going to be heroes. And we, you know, that's all doable. You also need to train local technical service providers, consultants, engineers, the lawyers that are the team that put together the deals. And you need to train the local government officials. So I think we now have 27 approvals that are needed for a little project in Tanzania. And part of that is happening with the Tanzania Investment Center, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done. So the financial mechanisms. A lot of these deals, we need to take concepts we know that work. For example, USAID has been a great champion of pooled financing. And there's been very important success in India, for example, where now it's adopted in all the states, where you can fund small projects. In fact, in the US, we have funded more than $40 billion of infrastructure transactions using pooled facilities. We need to really be financial engineers and put together streamlined mechanisms like that, as well as contingent financing facilities that will bring in the local domestic capital, the pension funds, and the sovereign wealth funds. And we need to integrate that into the ongoing operations of the government and the private sector. Finally, linkages. Linkages back home, your point. There are a lot of entrepreneurs and SMEs in this country, whether it's through SBA support programs, commerce programs, there's the Global Clean Technology Deployment Group. We need to be able to bring information on products, services that US entrepreneurs and others can bring. Because you're sitting there with a project sponsor, they don't know what solar equipment, what mini hydro. They don't know that now solar is being used to be able to do irrigation systems. I mean, there's such great stuff that we don't have the connections. And we can use web-based platforms, and the Swiss government has funded us. We have started to do that, but it's not done, to be able to close the linkages between the market and the demand on all fronts. And so I think there's, and also performance monitoring. We mustn't forget that. But I think there's a lot that needs to be done. If we can take the great leadership we have in the US government working with the private sector, but we need to have a work plan to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you. You really, Barbara, set some high expectations for those of us in the US government. Just met her 5 minutes ago, but she teed this up nicely for us. My name's Andy Herskowitz. I'm the coordinator for Power Africa and Trade Africa. Power Africa was announced by President Obama a little over a year ago as his initiative to double access to electricity in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's a whole-of-government initiative that involves many partners, including my colleagues from OPIC, which are really doing the lion's share of the work for Power Africa. And the initial goal was to add 10,000 megawatts and 20 million connections in six focus countries. And those focus countries are Kenya, Tanzania, and Ethiopia, Liberia, Nigeria, and Ghana. But Power Africa is about all of sub-Saharan Africa. So for example, and my colleague from OPIC will talk about this, of the $7 billion that originally was committed by the US government, $1.5 billion of that was financing from OPIC. And this is what makes Power Africa different. This is a different way for the US government to do business. It's a different way for donors to do business. This is rooted in partnership. It's not about the US government putting down a lot of money in developing large projects. It's about trying to demonstrate to the private sector that these countries are good places to invest and looking at what we can do to help bridge those market imperfections that are preventing the investments from happening. What you said resonated quite well, you know, quite a bit with me about donors and there being too much money out there, and I couldn't agree more. When President Obama tripled our goals during the African Leaders Summit this past August, he tripled our goals to now 30,000 megawatts and 60 million connections across all of sub-Saharan Africa. There's very good reason for that. He also announced a renewed budget commitment of $300 million a year. Now, anybody who knows anything about USAID or the energy sector knows that $300 million a year is not going to double access to electricity in sub-Saharan Africa. But that's what we asked for, and that's what we got. I didn't want $1 billion a year. I didn't want $2 billion a year, because as soon as we asked for $1 billion or $2 billion a year, people come looking to us for money to develop the projects themselves, and that's not what's needed. What's needed is that the private sector has to drive this development, and there's plenty of money to be made. When we talk about some of the issues with people not paying for electricity in rural areas, I don't buy that for a second. I've been overseas for the last 14 years working with USAID, and every time I travel to a country, to the most rural areas, I always take pictures of mud, little shacks with mud floors, sometimes just wrapped in plastic sheeting, where there is a satellite disk, because people will pay, and they figure out how to pay for satellite TV when they want it. I used to, even when I worked in Washington, D.C. as a lawyer, I did pro bono work for IUTA Inc., and I was always baffled. I say, how can we ask a lot of these, you know, indigent immigrants to pay for basic legal services? And I was told, people will figure out how to pay for the things that they really want and need. And that's what people do for electricity. People pay for kerosene, so maybe the first solution is to buy a little solar lantern where actually they have more reliable and cleaner access to electricity. And then they build up, just like the cell phones. No one would ever think with all the poverty in Africa that people would have cell phones, but people have cell phones. So it's upon us to figure out what are the appropriate market solutions for most of the people in sub-Saharan Africa. I'm not going to say that everybody in sub-Saharan Africa can have access to electricity just because can afford it, just like in the United States, not everybody can afford access to electricity. But for the most part, people will figure out how to make ends meet. The key comes down to really a person's own personal security and controlling sort of their own destiny. When you're a person who's living in a place where you're at the whim of the utility and not knowing whether there's going to be power or not. I lived for 5 years in the Dominican Republic, and I never knew when I was going to have power. And I've lived with poor families, and I've lived with rich families, and it was all in the same boat. You never know when you're going to have electricity, and you couldn't plan your day. And sometimes you'd sit for hours, or if you're wealthy, you spent thousands of dollars a month on backup fuel for a generator. But what people really want is they want to be able to know, what are those 2 hours a day that they're going to be able to charge their cell phone, or they're going to be able to study or do what they want to be able to control what that is. And there are a lot of low-cost solutions. Power Africa was originally designed as an economic growth play. It was a trip that was taken by senior U.S. government officials looking at countries in sub-Saharan Africa that were enjoying rapid economic growth and looking at what the key constraints would be to keep them on that path to rapid economic growth. You look at a factory, for example, in Nairobi that's producing 40,000 garments a day for export, but when the power goes out in Nairobi, they're burning dirty diesel generators, which makes them non-competitive in the long run. So it's looking at how can we make sure manufacturing and jobs will continue and that these countries will stay on that path. But we realized very quickly into it that you can't ignore the millions of people in sub-Saharan Africa who aren't even part of the plan to be part of the grid for the next decade, which is why Power Africa launched Beyond the Grid. So we have a sub-initiative that's taking into account all of the off-grid people who aren't even part of that. And then we have the major grid development as part of our plan. Now, a key part of Power Africa, like I said, it's not about having us spend a lot of money there. It's not about having us have a bunch of Americans and American companies necessarily who are taking the lead in developing every project. We do want to create opportunities for American companies because American companies have some of the best technology in the world. But as I said to our colleagues who were hosting over this last week from East Africa for the Power Africa Geothermal Roadshow, it's not simply not economical for US companies to ship hundreds of employees overseas. So you can pass all the immigration laws that you want to try to control the import of labor into your country. But in the United States, we take our security very seriously. For us to put any expat overseas, it costs us probably $500,000 a person just to deal with all the security measures, as our friend from Clemens could probably tell us, because of all the liability issues that we have. So the numbers speak for themselves. Companies want to build local capacity. GE, when it first got on the continent 4 years ago, about 90% of its staff was expatriate staff and 10% local. And after 4 years, they've built the capacity, and now it's the opposite. It's about 90% local staff and about 10% expatriate staff. And that's important. Power Africa is about building local capacity, training local lawyers, and not bringing a bunch of people into a hotel room and spending $100,000 on a training and hoping that the right people show up. It's about finding who that key person is at a ministry who's negotiating the power purchasing agreement and partnering them with someone and making sure that person knows what he or she is doing because they're going to drive the deals. So Power Africa's approach is very transaction focused. It's about focused. It's about closing specific transactions that will push reforms. It's not about bringing in experts who will come and opine on the state of the industry and the sector. It's about sitting down with the private sector and finding out what's a specific obstacle to this particular project, be it political, financial, or technical, and looking at which tools we can pull from the entire US government, World Bank, African Development Bank, Government of Sweden, and any other partner's toolbox to solve that obstacle. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. John.
Thank you, and that's a very good lead into what we do. Andy said, you know, we're one of the participants, and hopefully we're delivering OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, U.S. government's development finance institution, not the oil cartel in Vienna, we always say. You know, we're really an instrument. I think OPIC is an instrument and one of the tools that that the U.S. government and the international community has in trying to achieve the goal of mobilizing private capital. Now, we have three principal products where we provide finance. We're a lender, basically. We support privately managed investment funds that put equity in play in emerging markets and transitioning economies. And then we also offer risk mitigation instruments in the form of political risk insurance. That's the department that I'm ahead of, where we cover the risks that investors, lenders, and contractors face when they're looking to put capital at risk, but they're concerned about political violence, the ability to convert and transfer local currency into dollars and get it out, get the money back out, their profits, their dividends, or where they're worried about what happens if there's a government change or if there's some kind of expropriation, nationalization, but also breach of contract, power purchase agreement, where an independent power producer, a solar project developer says, I'm willing to do this, but I'm going to do a 10-year or 20-year power purchase agreement with the government or some part of the government, and I'm worried that what happens if they don't pay me and they stop paying me. I'm supplying the power. My long-term profit is, you know, delivering power and getting paid over this period of time. What happens if things change and I don't get paid? How do I cover that risk? That's really what we offer. And we offer it for the U.S. side, so that sometimes that can pose a little bit of we're not a perfect fit on the development side because we're not purely developmental. We want to do something that is developmental, has a strong developmental impact, but it's also got to be commercially sustainable, commercially viable, and it has to have some kind of U.S. element in the deal from the private sector in some form, and it differs from each of the three products we offer. But I think maybe most relevant to today's conversation, and in fact in the way we operate effectively, is how to be better integrated and complementary to some of the other initiatives that are going out, with the idea being that really ultimately the mobilizing private sector, private investment, in this case, African energy projects in the power sector, energy efficiency, sustainable resource projects, that's really the long-term key, is to try to mobilize the private sector to do this, both to get projects done that may face impediments but are attractive and will have strong development impacts, but also can then be a demonstration effect both for long-term, for future investors, but also working with the policy initiatives, with the technical assistance initiatives, with the international community, and with other institutions and agencies in the U.S. government and elsewhere, as well as in the host countries, to really reformat, to refine, define an appropriate legal and regulatory environment that ultimately is the key to mobilizing private investment and getting real private capital flows to come in. So that's what OPIC has done in a number of ways, is try to work with that and with other institutions, both in the private sector, private banks, MIGA, World Bank, some of the bilateral institutions that are similar to what OPIC does, both on the political risk insurance side and on the finance side, in Germany, the UK, the multilateral development banks. But there's so many players, and I think the key challenge to us is to work both with some of the players on the international public side, but also with private companies, insurers. Clements, we work very closely with Dante and with others, as to how can we tailor our instruments in a way that lets the private sector commit capital, provide services, show their expertise, and attract other participants, both in terms of capital, but services, engineering, legal, financial, et cetera, in a way that really maximizes the possibility, the opportunities to go forward by underwriting or covering the risks in a prudent way, but that also yield really, really strong developmental benefits. So that's what we try to do, and try to work carefully with folks at sometimes an ad hoc basis. We try to work carefully. I will say, last thing I'll say is, for internally in challenge in OPIC sometimes, is so many of our people are deal-focused that it's hard to convince them sometimes to stay involved when their policy initiatives, you know, to share the lessons learned, because they're on to the next deal. Or sometimes, frankly, they're skeptical a little bit about sitting in too much and providing the lessons that they've learned by writing a power purchase agreement or a contract, insurance contract, or some kind of project finance arrangement with players, or to invest in a deal if it's an equity fund. They're not necessarily, for business confidential reasons, hesitant about sharing that information, but they just wonder, is it worth my time? And more importantly, is the private sector partner that we're in, are they willing to do it and to share those lessons? Those lessons can be very important, especially when we think about all the initiatives to try to reform legal and regulatory regimes that really are key to getting greater certainty to, you know, really ultimately what the key, which is the private sector being willing to commit much larger dollars than we may have, or that the donor community has in terms of grant funds and technical assistance. So
thank you. Thank you very much. I guess we can open it up for questions. The gentleman right here.
Two questions, really, specifically. First, one to you, and then one to Mr. Hershkowitz. You mentioned for Power Africa the six countries that you're working with. This is a model program or a trial program. What about the other countries?
So we now...
Anything being done or what can they do to
So obviously our resources were limited initially, but OPIC's commitment always has been to do work in any of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa where they can operate. Export-import bank the same. Export-import bank's commitment was $5 billion of that $7 billion initially to do projects. And so the transactional agencies are being a lot more opportunistic to look for projects. If you look at Power Africa's annual report, we actually have and it's available online at usaid.gov/powerafrica. There's a spread, basically a map that shows all the work that different U.S. government agencies are doing related to energy in Africa. We chose to take this focused approach just for resources in a handful of countries to see what kind of impact we could have towards pushing reforms, and by having people who are on the ground that could look for new transactions and really push on current transactions. And that seems to have worked. In our first year, we've helped reach financial close close to 3,000 of the 10,000 megawatts of power. But what we're doing now is we're hiring regional transaction advisors, one in East Africa, one in West Africa, one in Southern Africa. We're putting transaction advisors in the power pools as well. And their job is to try to find deals that will be somehow transformational, otherwise significant, and to basically allow us to support additional deal flow to help us achieve our greater goals. We're now going through the process of figuring out, you know, what expansion of Power Africa might look like once more resources become available.
Let me ask just a follow up.
Yeah, the second part of my question is a different subject. It goes to you, Mr. Clean. And this goes back earlier. Ask about the security issues, how they affect everything everyone's doing over there. Specifically, you mentioned earlier that your company is involved with maritime issues. As you know, piracy in East Africa has been, if not contained, at least addressed. And the current, to my knowledge, of the crisis is in the West Africa, Atlantic Africa, and particularly the Gulf of Guinea, for example, where there's a different approach. And the pirates there in the East Africa, were doing primarily ransoming the ships in the Gulf of Guinea. They're taking the ships, they're taking the cargo off, pumping the oil off, and leaving the ships. That's just one example of the security problems I see over West Africa. How large an issue is that for everything you're doing?
It's a serious issue, yes. We manage, I mentioned earlier, the Liberian ship registry, which is the second largest ship registry in the world. Some of our ships are actually dealing with this problem right now as we speak, so it's a very serious issue for us. We try to do the best as we can as a ship registry, but at the end, each ship is... has to make certain decisions whether they want to take this route or that route, and it does affect cost, it does affect, So security is a serious issue when it comes to the shipping industry. Piracy is a very serious issue in Somalia, and it's much more, the issue is much more deeper than just, a bunch of pirates waiting for the ship to show up. There are stories about, different ports where people work there are related to different pirates. It's a very complicated issue but to give a very simple answer, it's a very serious issue for us.
Let me just, add a perspective to that. Anytime Tom Hanks makes a movie about an issue, to Lee's point earlier, I think part of the job is to change the optics. If you look at global maritime trade, piracy, yes, it's an inconvenience, but it is but a drop in the bucket. And there are a lot of solutions, and they're very robust solutions dating to the 16, 1700s on how to ensure shipborne transport and how to ensure the types of events that are occurring. I'm sure Fadi's company, the Liberian Registry, has ample shipborne security and countermeasures and things like this. I think that the companies that get that piece right on piracy and shipborne risks simply build it into the cost of doing business. To say that you're just not going to travel any longer, that you're going to deviate, it's an inconvenience, right, in my opinion. But the only time you address it, and I would look to my colleagues in the government, is when you address the things that are sending people to sea to seek economic help, right? Exactly. So the solution is not an insurance one. We could price Fadi's Liberian Registry risks all day long, and the market could absorb that without an issue from an insurance and a security vantage point. But the long-term solution will be derived when you have developmental solutions that stop people from Somalia and the rest of the countries that have deep, deep, deep developmental challenges from going to the water to look for hope.
I agree with that.
I was going to say, so some of you might question, if you read my bio, how a guy who spent a decade in Latin America and who's a lawyer ended up coordinating Power Africa. So there's a lot of lessons to be learned. I worked in Peru working with alternative development programs. Because you nailed it. I mean, the reason people are robbing ships and why you have conflict is when people have access to healthcare and schools and a job, they're not looking to do these other things, which is why development is so incredibly fundamental. And having access to electricity is an important part of that. It's people who don't have other things to do and they have no other hope is when they do this. But I do want to offer another perspective as well. You also nailed it about people sort of pricing the risk into what they're doing. The business sector is going to do what they're going to do. I remember about maybe 8 years ago or so, I was putting together the first loan guarantee programs that USAID ever did in Haiti. It was right after one of the coups there. I don't remember what it was. And I remember explaining to the credit review board at USAID, they said, well, how can we do this? It's unstable. And I explained to them, these banks have been operating in Haiti for 40 years through multiple governments. They factor and they've priced all of this into the risk. The one thing that is stable in Haiti are the banks and the private sector. And it got through, and the loan guarantee program ended up doing wonderfully. So people who are willing to do business there, you know, are going to continue doing that. And the last thing I would say is, where is the good place to do business these days? You know, I was finding, when I moved recently from Kenya to Pretoria, I was going through every country. You know, you've got Al-Shabaab and, you know, potential threat in half the countries, Boko Haram in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Terrorists, you know, their goal is to try to scare people from doing business, but when you're scared to go anywhere, you're just going to have to just eventually just keep on operating, and that's what people are doing. It's kind of, they're actually failing. When you say we're losing, I don't think we're losing because we're getting to the point where we're just getting hardened to it and everything's just becoming business as usual. You might change your behavior a little bit, maybe not go to a shopping mall, but at the end of the day, you know, that's, yeah, I mean, I'm serious.
Let me try and respond to
that.
Yeah,
go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
The reason, and I think that the facts are the facts, if you look at the statistics of the unemployed youth across Africa, and on one hand, it's incredibly impressive. When you're there working on the ground, you have people that are just so committed. They'll say, we work for you without getting paid. Can you, in your training course, give us a certificate? There is, and of course, in ICT, you know, you have incredible creativeness in developing technology applications. But that being said, when you look, and let's again go back to energy, because I think it's a really good indicator. We have this vacuum where it is not possible and it is too expensive, as you used in your example of GE. You cannot develop projects with expats that fly in. It's, you know, or one or two transaction advisors. What we need to do is to create the local soldiers that, because there's a lot of pieces in the puzzle that need to do that. And so what concerns me is that those programs are not in place. Yeah. When I look at the government development plans, the prospectus, which was put together by Norway and Sweden, there is still, and I think it's a development model, the IFC was given the right to hire the transaction advisory people, okay? That is going to be an enclave owned by them, staffed by them. So, you know, we need to think how we're going to actually build that. And the program we developed for the UN Capital Development Fund actually had a program that would start to do that process, and it was underfunded under the One UN program. You know, there's so many transaction costs, but I really think we need to worry. I was in Abuja, where we had a forum on Africa infrastructure. Same thing. We had sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, the people that are running them, and it's endemic. They don't have the people that are trained to be able to do the work there. So I think we need to look really hard at how all the different components we pull together and do the training. That's where I think we're losing the battle.
Okay, gotcha.
And also the linkages with U.S. business.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I mean, that's one of the things that Power Africa is doing, is we're absolutely looking at how we build the local capacity. In fact, I've said to our own staff at USAID, when their first inclination was to hire an expatriate to come in, I said, it's going to cost $600,000 to hire an expatriate. I go, I would rather you hire three or four local people, and if two of them don't work out, we're still better off than hiring an expatriate at this point. And I think that message has gotten through. We're seeing with our institutional support contract being based on the continent, we're hiring some really excellent people, and we're continuing to encounter more and more people. being on the continent as the first U.S. presidential initiative ever headquartered outside the United States is giving us access to a whole array of people rather than people just sort of dropping in, meeting whoever you meet at a hotel. But you're really getting to know the local players, which is helping us build capacity quite a bit.
Let's see if there, I think we have some more questions here. Andrew, yeah.
Thanks, Andrew Holland. I'm a senior fellow for energy here at ASP. So my question is actually about political risk, but on this side. You know, we talk about African governments and everything like this, but Power Africa is great and impressive, but can we, what are we doing to make sure that it exists beyond the end of 2016? And into the next administration, into the next Congresses, and this sort of stuff. How can this sort of stuff become durable? And OPIC, you know, as if I were in a business, I would look at OPIC and say, and before I started working with you all, I'd say, huh, your business model looks a lot like Export Import Bank, and Congress is taking some really close look at that. You know, we have some real sort of political problems here in the United States in keeping these, they're not foreign aid projects, but they are, you know, foreign aid has very tough getting a political constituency in this in the United States. So what can we do to, on this side to help build these constituencies and make it durable?
Thank you, Andrew. Let's get one more question, if you don't mind, and then the gentleman in the back there.
Ellington Kumba with Center for Global Research. My question really is directed at Dante, and it's to do with access to credit at an individual level. Obviously, I think in America, obviously, everybody has access to credit, and that's how, I guess, you can have, you create a middle class. Now, I don't know what your experience was working in 13 different odd markets in Africa where there's no access to credit. Most markets are cash-driven, you know. So what was your experience, and how did you mitigate against, you know, individual credit risk?
I we'll just get one last question from the back there.
Hi, Peter Koharis, I was just on the other panel. John and Dante, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what sort of market demand for new products or new types of coverages are you seeing, and maybe some of your responses to those demands.
Thanks, Peter. And just, let me just add one other thing. I really like the examples that you brought up, but if you don't mind going in a little deeper and giving us, you know, let's say I'm a business here in the United States. I'm interested in investing in the energy sector in Ethiopia or any other country. How do I go about it? Who do I discuss this with? How can you be helpful to me other than the macro picture? The fact that you can talk to somebody at the Ministry of Electricity or the Ministry of Energy that can negotiate a power purchasing agreement, how long does that take? A month, a year, 10 years? Barbara mentioned there were 27 approvals that are needed for one small project. Something like this is probably, you need at least, and I'm just shooting in the crowd here, 50 or 100 approvals. How do you deal with this? Is there something that you could do to offer businesses here to address this issue? And the other thing is, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, but just from a U.S. government perspective, what can the U.S. government do to protect American investments in different African countries? Are there meaning, and we brought up the issue of corruption earlier. It's a serious issue. What can businesses, I mean, what can the government do to support these businesses to untangle some of these issues that will face them? So I don't know what you...
To me? Okay, so I got a few questions. All right, so why don't I give a couple of examples. Really what Power Africa is meant to be is an interagency one-stop shop. In fact, one of John's colleagues will be moving to Pretoria in a few weeks, who will sit in the Power Africa coordinator's office to focus on OPIC types of transactions. OPIC already has somebody in South Africa who promotes OPIC deals and the U.S. Trade and Development Agency has someone based in Johannesburg. The Foreign Commercial Service has someone based there. But basically, all kinds of companies come to us for inquiries. Not just talking about, you know, a smaller solar company, someone who's selling solar lanterns, GE, which one would want to do a 1,000-megawatt project, a hydro company. We deal with everyone. So it's a question of identifying what the specific need is and then making sure they connect with the right agency or multiple agencies. It's the first time that people don't have to knock on 12 different doors. They come to one door and then we sort of direct them to where they're supposed to go. In fact, we have a new staff member who just joined our team today. A company sent me an inquiry, asked her to respond. She sent me the draft, and her draft was only talking about one program that USAID had, and I had to go back to her. I said, no. There are a lot of other agencies involved here. There's a lot of other tools. So I have to go back and forth with her and train her on this, but making sure that people are aware of everything. But a specific deal. There's a company called NextGen Solar, which has a 5-megawatt solar project in Tanzania. And they came really to OPIC for financing, but their issue was that they weren't able to get a power purchasing agreement beyond 15 years from the government. So OPIC sent the letter to the government and really kind of pushed hard to get the government to extend the power purchasing agreement to up to 20 years. And in fact, the government switched the standard PPA to 25 years. And as a result, the OPIC financing is able to, you know, become available. At the same time, the U.S. Trade and Development Agency has a program along with OPIC called the Africa Clean Energy Financing Facility that can provide some upfront development capital. At the same time, USAID has some technical assistance programs that we're able to provide some assistance to this one particular company. So we're basically each agency, and we meet on a regular basis. Not a day goes by that I'm not in touch with at least six other U.S. government agencies. But in addition, systematically, every 2 weeks, the interagency gets together in Washington. We feed information from the field to Washington. So there's this constant flow of information. I'm from Washington, D.C. This is the best way the U.S. government has ever worked in my entire life. Never lived in any city than Washington. I'm a true Washingtonian. So I can tell you, this is the way government is supposed to work. We're talking, we're exchanging information, no one's feeling threatened by anyone. And as a result, we're able to advance deals. The question about political support internally. Our results have to speak for themselves. But what I will say is that we enjoy widespread bipartisan support. And if you look at the Electrify Africa legislation that passed, that was sponsored by the Republican chairman, Ed Royce. So I think as long as we continue to produce results, people will continue to support us. It's less important. I mean, and I, as you can tell from just hearing me now, I tend to be very honest and frank. If we're failing, I'll be the first guy to tell you that we're failing and we need to change track. So if things aren't working, I'm every time I come back, I engage with the Hill and talk to them about what's working, what's not working, what we can do better. And I think as long as we're open and honest, because we're all working towards the same goals, I think we'll be okay.
So a couple of interesting questions I think emerged. I mean, the question on credit, it's vital, right? The how I operated in 32 countries, not 13, in an absence of credit, with a highly priced vehicle, with tangible investments that don't magically disappear, ultimately, the investment itself is part a job creation step. The United States in its own development was led by gazelles, small, medium-sized enterprises, entrepreneurs that are willing to take these types of risks for the long haul. And the same holds true with credit and the ability to create purchasing power within a lot of these economies in these countries. With deference to my friends from the government, I think in the long run, private sector solutions for a lot of these challenges is the pathway that will sort of lead to local job creation, local demand, local purchasing power, credit solutions. There just is no bilateral way. I mean, I would subscribe to, if you've read the book by Dambisa Moyo, Dead Aid, a lot of the official development aid, ODA, that simply props up regimes that are not letting the income trickle down into the real economy. I mean, that is a part of the problem. 50 years of doing that is what we're trying to rectify right now. And so I like the fact that U.S. firms are not looking at Africa as a region for extractive resources, and that the infrastructure isn't simply from the power plant to the port. That's just robbing a nation, or a continent rather, of its resources. Now it is Walmart building brick and mortar investments. You have academics like C.K. Prahalad talking about the fortune at the base of the pyramid. And so that is what's going to tip the continent over. And I think, again, you know, you have the opportunity in the African context to leapfrog technologies that are antiquated, like brick and mortar, fixed line telephony, and brick and mortar banking, et cetera. So it's only one way to go. As far as demand for political risk insurance and these types of solutions, in fact, we're discussing with OPIC ways of increasing demand for it, because part of the challenge I see is that these types of products require there's a lot of barriers to entry. It's a fairly complex process to work with and go through. OPIC is doing a lot of great work in terms of financing small and medium-sized enterprises, but on the political risk side, people only demand it when they perceive there is a risk, the very definition of adverse selection. When it becomes part of the package and you gain some degree of check-the-box simplicity, then it moves from being a cost of doing business to a catalyst for business something that can help drive investment, as opposed to, I will only use it in the countries where I know Hugo Chavez is going to steal my stuff. So I think, you know, the catalytic properties of the government, of Power Africa, OPIC, a lot of the discussions we've had, is where I would like to see, you know, the debate and then, of course, the action emerging.
Can I just make a point before going on? Is, I think one of the holes that is holding up deals a lot is the relationship between the national government and the local governments. For example, again in Tanzania, you have the presidential initiative SAGAT for agriculture, which includes energy projects. Big G8, you know, all these letters of commitment by major U.S. and other firms. And the guys that run the SAGAT Center will tell you the deals are stuck. And there is a huge level of mistrust by the local communities of this investment. And one of the key problems when you ask the question, what do you do if you're a foreigner? First issue is land. Who owns the land? And by the way, the head of the Rural Energy Agency and the head of the Tanzania Investment Promotion Agency don't agree on what is illegal, what is acceptable. One says you can have a note in Swahili, handwritten, and that's okay as a basis for an investment. And the other one will say, you got to be kidding. We're not going to stand behind that. So there's a lot of issues. And again, I think it just...
What would Power Africa do about that?
Well, that's one of the issues, is I think that it's very important for the U.S. government to work very closely with development partners on the systemic problems. And really, and the dialectic of doing it with deals is very effective, you know? Because then people get motivated to make a change in their
It's a model of putting the big carrot on the table and saying, if you want these transactions to happen, this is what you need to do. And you hope that you'll slowly chip away at the reforms. We had this debate amongst the interagency just a week and a half ago as we talk about expansion of, you know, you've got sort of one group who'd want to be opportunistic and say, let's just chase deals, and then you've got those agencies that focus on policy reform, say we gotta have this really robust policy reform push, and we have to figure out how you marry those both of those. Because what you see in a country like Tanzania, there are a lot of countries going into Tanzania and investing, but they're kind of waiting on the sidelines. They're doing it, and they keep waiting for us to come in to help solve some of the problems with the utility. So you can't tell the private sector, we're gonna use your transactions to help push reforms, but then not have us play any role in pushing on those actual reforms. At the end of the day, they're going to lose their money. Mm-hmm. There have been several times when people have asked me about particular countries, where should I invest? What do you think? And I was very cautious. These are the risks that you're taking by investing there. And I've said this to the host government. I said, you need to help me make the case for people to invest in your country, because Power Africa is meant to be a stamp of approval that this is a good place to invest.
And how
if it's not, I can't say that.
What about the response? Can you just talk a little bit about the African response? You've talked a lot about the U.S. role, but some of those African leaders, the countries, the government officials, how have they, I'm sure they talk the talk, but have they walked the walk?
So for any of you familiar with Latin America, my last job was the mission director in Ecuador, where I heard, I think, people from the government were given a quarter for every time they mentioned the word sovereignty. So I've become very accustomed to to listening to country, but also it is a question of being respectful. I mean, of sovereignty is extremely important in a country. It's not the U.S. government telling people what to do, but we have to demonstrate what the benefit is to them. The challenge that we face, and this is where donor coordination is extremely, extremely important. I'll tell you what we did, is that, and that if the U.S. government asks somebody, you know, or doesn't ask, we suggest they do something to attract the private sector investment, and they don't like what we're suggesting, you've got a million other donors who are lined up to give money, which is why I never wanted our Power Africa to be about us giving money. We're trying to give objective business advice and say to them, fine, you go ahead, and you can go ahead and get the donor funding. We've seen this a lot with geothermal right now, so this is where we try to do something. I got to Nairobi, and I saw donors tripping over themselves without coordinating for geothermal projects. Everyone gets excited about geothermal. Clean, renewable, baseload energy. You know, it's 20,000 megawatts. Well, it's expensive for exploratory drilling, but once it's online, you know, it's you know, costs about this much. It's like as cheap as hydro, if not cheaper. People get excited about it. So everyone wants to throw money at it. We weren't coordinating with one another. And what we're seeing is that governments were just running around with donor money, drilling wells without having the adequate, you know, research that they need. And every time you try to drill a well, it costs you probably $5 million. It's just donor money just being thrown away. So what we did is we created a position, we embedded someone within the African Development Bank's offices in Nairobi, and her role was to try to coordinate all the donors in the lower C sense of the word, not to mandate what they're doing, but map out what the donors were doing, come up with a comprehensive strategy, both for the region and for each country. And that's what we've been working on, and it's actually helped us quite a bit, because we're all aware of, you know, we're all swapping stories about what governments are doing, and people are hearing us. We're working in a much more cohesive manner. That's a very specific, narrow niche. Donor coordination for geothermal in East Africa. But that's what you need to do, because having a bunch of donors get together every 2 months, sit around a table, talk what they're up to, you know, talk about what they're up to, you never get anything done. So you need someone dedicated full-time to very specific niches if you actually want to have results.
Thank you. Maybe what I'll talk just about, there are a couple of questions. Who does someone talk with about moving a deal for the U.S. business? And Andy mentioned, you know, Power Africa. I'll put it in the OPEC context, but we really do rely on sources from outside of OPEC. There's one guy based, Peter Ballinger's been the guy who's based in Johannesburg for covering all of Africa. And now there's another guy, Peter Van de Doel, who's going to go join Power Africa in Pretoria from OPEC, but you know we rely on AID people, on Power Africa people, on in chambers of commerce, investment promotion agencies in various countries that are looking for and understand what we do. Private brokers in the insurance side, deal developers. There's a program called Enterprise Development Network. Really is to feed projects. I would give an example, sort of personal example, that when I first joined OPEC, I was a U.S. Treasury, and I came over and joined OPEC to be their regional representative in the Balkans region in Southeast Europe. And the idea and the position that was created wasn't just me, but there was also an EXIM person and a TDA person, and we were housed in the U.S. Embassy at the Commerce Department. But the idea was there was a big debate between the foreign ministries and the finance ministries and the multilateral development banks about how to respond after Kosovo. And after the NATO campaign ended, and the question was, you know, do you do Marshall Plan Part 2 with big donor money, or do you do something more focused on private sector mobilization? And, you know, really, I think the latter won because the realization gradually dawned on people that there wasn't enough money there. So, you know, making a big pledge just risked, and I think this is relevant in the African context right now, is that if you talk about donor money, then you're probably not going to have enough resources to do there. The risk of disappointment, as it was in the Balkans, was that you don't, if you start talking about Marshall Plan 2 and big pumping in of official donor finance, and it's not there, you're gonna, the risk of return to conflict and away from prosperity is significant. So the focus instead was on mobilizing private capital. So at that time, there was a single office called the Finance Center. It's very similar to what Peter Ballinger is doing at the U.S. Consulate in Johannesburg, and liaising with Andy's colleagues and others to try to maximize the potential deal flow both on U.S. investors, but also on sound projects that might need a U.S. investor. And that's, so it's not a perfect construct at all in terms of, like, how do we match deals, but it's the best we can do in terms of trying to put together the various instruments we can do. And it is working. I would underscore what Andy said about it. This is a real example of how the donor coordination and the interagency cooperation is working quite well so that the instruments are more properly aligned and targeted. In terms of what the U.S. government can do to protect investors, OPICs, and I'll just talk, I really didn't and don't want to go into a spiel on OPIC, but political risk concerns, so I'll give you an example, not so much a marketing promo, but the we offer political risk insurance, and what I always say is that one of the big benefits of OPIC political risk insurance is to get someone on the plane and look at a deal. So someone knows a sector, and they have good partners. They might from the U.S. side or elsewhere, or they're trying to attract other partners in who have capital and interest in doing something, but are worried about fill in the country: Indonesia, Tanzania, Kenya, South Africa. But and they've never been there. So knowing that you can do political risk cover on the risk there gets them on the plane and looks at their partners. They get on the ground and they might see, and they often do, a totally different situation on the ground than what they thought before they get on, particularly from the U.S., one might not be surprised to hear. But that, it's true. It's a way to get on the plane. Now, we can then cover, provide political risk cover. We can finance it. We have investment funds just on the OPIC side. But there are other participants and private providers of insurance, finance, private fund managers also. But the idea is to sort of put together and pool capital that allows something to go with forward. With respect to OPIC and the political risk insurance side, what a main thing we do is we have the ability to advocate on behalf both at the sovereign and the sub-sovereign level when there's interference with a business operation. So if someone has a contract, say, to do a waste management facility in a municipality and they stop getting paid or there starts being problems, they're delivering, they're performing, and they're not getting paid, or there's interruptions, or they needed some kind of access to a rail or a road link and it stops being limited or the price goes up, that can be an incident of a creeping expropriation. We find out, we go to our embassy, we go to the host government, we say, look, if you don't stop this, we may have to pay a claim. And if we have a claim, we have rights for recovery against the national government. And back to the leverage angle, many times we're engaged at the national level of saying, the Minister of Foreign Affairs or the Ministry of Finance wants to encourage foreign direct investment in their country. We can say, look, you are proposing, your aim is to mobilize, increase, attract more private capital and foreign investment in your country. But if this happens, we pay a claim, the word will get around that this is indeed a risky place to do business. We have the right and will recover against you under our bilateral agreement with you, and you'll get a black eye as a destination for foreign direct investment. Let's head off this problem before it ripens to the point where they have a claim, and our investor will continue to go on deliver services effectively, and you won't have the negative impacts on our bilateral relationship. And it's more than just OPIC, it's the U.S. government, and as well as the impact on potential investment from the foreign private investor sector. So that's a leverage point that we've used very effectively, often well before having to pay a deal or a claim on a particular project that we insure.
Thank you. Dante, anything else you'd like to add?
So I think, is this the final word?
Sure.
Sure. Well, I guess it remains for all of us, I think, on the American Security Project side to say thanks, of course, to this distinguished panel, Fadi, a distinguished moderator, who got to say a few nice words earlier in the panel on private equity. What we were hoping to achieve with this day, I hope, has been achieved. And I know the American Security Project will broadcast this far and wide for those who we could not reach in the room. Was one, the notion that there is a direct correlation to American interests and American national security in terms of how we deploy capital, what types of solutions are available on the risk front. I think John just makes a very powerful testament to what the U.S. government can do through OPIC and carrying both a big stick and a big carrot, which very few can say they can do in the event of a loss due to these risks. There's also ample solutions available in the private sector to address the risk, and my final remark would just simply be that we have to look at a lot of these challenges from a catalytic lens. It's too easy to get caught up in the headlines, and the difference in my view between risk and uncertainty is that risk you could always measure, and uncertainty creates bank runs and panics, and often it's just optical. It's the Ebola crisis, it's now contaminated 80 people in Texas, and this type of stuff becomes panic-driven, and it's not really informed by granular information
on risk, on investments, on opportunities. And I would just encourage the folks in the audience and the folks, you know, in the wider world who hear any of this content to get off the sidelines, get deeply informed. In my view, there is no such thing as a bad risk. There's only a mispriced risk. But there's also risk in doing nothing, right? And sitting on the sidelines and letting Chinese firms and firms from Europe and firms from India and firms from the rest of the world tap into the African growth narrative. And if American firms don't do this well, I think it's at our expense and it's at their own expense. And the developmental consequences are broad. They will lead to continued piracy, so Fadi's ships will never be safe. They will lead to safe havens so that we're never safe at home. And it's all correlated. So thanks again to the audience and to the panelists.